going to take time, though. It's not an overnight thing, but we got to start the process of transformation. Like Jimmy Baldwin said, we got to name the problem if we're going to face the problem and solve a problem. If you can't, if you don't confront it and name it and say, hey, this anti-Black racism is a problem in Amherst. And everybody say, all right, we agree. And that was done. The reparations for Amherst, the group started by Matt and Corrine Andrews and Michelle Miller, white people in Amherst, they got the petition. They got the 13 members of the town council to approve it. And it said what I've just said. It acknowledged the history of harm, anti-Black racism and harm of the Black people, of Black people of Amherst, past, present, and right now on, and pledged that we would, that the town would work to root that out, to resolve, to address that anti-Black racism. All right. Now the Heritage Commission, our Reparations Commission or African Heritage Reparations Assembly is now developing the plan. What does that call for? That call for us to work within that 2000 to get that 2000 together to talk about what do we want? What is most pressing? What are the harms that need to be addressed? Okay. To then inform the process of the town of what we need done. So that's where we are. That's how we're building this thing. And we look to accomplish some dramatic things. It's a small town, but maybe it can then inspire the bigger places, the New York cities, the Bostons, the Chicagos, the LAs. And we find they are stepping up. They are beginning to, Boston just introduced a measure to create a reparations commission in Boston. Okay, Chicago, LA, all these places are now stepping up. Those are where bigger numbers of our people are. Houston, Texas, New Orleans, Atlanta. But our little town has been, in a way, lit a candle, lit a flame that is now being seen in many other places.
How do I word this?
Words matter.
do you ever get exhausted explaining to white people just racism or anything about Black culture, you know, certain nuances like colloquials or why was it wrong that a policeman killed an unarmed Black man?
So I'm an educator.
Yeah.
So part of what I do, not only within, you know, the university system, and I've taught different places because I'm an adjunct, but also I have my own business that does consulting. And in a way, it's just part, it's an extension of education. It, of course, is exhausting. But I was always passionate about education. And so, as I said, the folks who need to be healed, the folks who need to do the unlearning are the white people. You know, I think our young people right now are extremely sophisticated about the language in terms of the harms and the injustices and the inequalities that continually happen, right? And in a way, social media has helped that. I mean, there's a lot of bad part of social media, but there's some good parts of social media that our young people are utilizing, you know, in ways that I think are educating them and helping educate one another through dialogue and conversation. White people, on the other hand, because media is so siloed, they are tuning in to their own social media, right? Their own conversations that do not provide the language in which to talk about, even when they see it. They may see it. They may feel it in terms of their friends or family members, because our families are much more diverse these days. They don't have the language. in which to parse through what is going on, you know, historically, and what's the current problems. And so I think my job as an educator in many ways is to not only do the explaining, provide a bridge, but to teach them the critical skills in which they could utilize, whether it's now or in the future, to understand that is unjust. Folks are just like me. They deserve, you know, to live a good quality of life, to have good housing, education, to, you know, lessen that wealth gap. And I am part of the historical inequality as well as what's going on to the future. So I need to do something about it. And so as an educator, I think it's really important. It's critically important that we provide those skills, not just to our young people of color, but to white folks, young, old, whatever, in order to participate in those conversations. And, you know, it's like once you have that knowledge, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
And really demand of them, if you're going to say Black Lives Matter and put a sign in your yard, you need to do something more.
Yeah.
You need to try to correct the inequalities of the past so that we could go into the present, your children, your grandchildren, where we meet one another on equal footing. So, yeah, it's exhausting. I try to take my vitamins. I try to come home to the community, to my family, you know, and to my friends and be nurtured to sustain myself when I have to go out and teach again. But it's critically important. And it's important now because there's so much misinformation out there, you know, and the suppression of our history.
Yeah.
You know, we saw that with the 1619 Project.
Mm-hmm.
So it's critically important that we continue this work and pass the torch so that young folks like you, you know, are able to do the same as what I'm doing. This is educational, right? Someone's going to hear this.
Yeah.
Hopefully someone's going to get curious, particularly, you know, white people listening, and they're going to do their research. They're going to say, now that I know, I need to grow and I need to do something more.
Yeah.
I'll jump in on that one real quick, Atil. Let me say this. A comrade of mine, an Iranian comrade of mine back like in the, right after, around the time of the Iranian Revolution, early 80s, once told me, don't be tired. He said that was kind of an expression in the Iranian revolutionary circles. Don't be tired. We can't get tired. But let me say this. Get paid. Get your money. Get your money. All right? Yeah, do this work. You can do it. Do it. Do it with the white people. Do it for anybody. You know, I've spoken in China. Jinan. I've spoken in central China, Wuhan. I've spoken in Japan. I've spoken. You know, get your money, though. Okay, yeah, you can do this. You can share, but get paid, get your money. And you know what? I'm even like, because we're all right here, but the stipend, and I say this as a plug, if you want to hire us, I'll donate it to a nonprofit.
Yeah.
You can send the check rather than in my name, send it directly to Sankofa Gumbo Incorporated, or send it to the National Council for Black Studies, or I can, Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History. I can give you a list of nonprofits I'm on the boards of. I work and push. If you know, and you don't have to pay it to me directly because that's not what it's about. But if you want this, understand it's not free.
Yeah.
And understand that, you know, I'm not too exhausted to do it for you, but I need something from you.
Yeah.
If you want this. Yeah. So here's the thing.
Because it's not our job to educate something that white people created.
But turn that around. Yeah. But it is our job.
Yeah.
If you want it.
Yeah.
I'll do it as a job. But pay. And pay what I deserve. Pay what I, you know, and again, it can be paid to a nonprofit, to a cooperative, to whatever I'm building. But pay, yes. This isn't free. All right. Mm-hmm. So that's one part of it. The other part is this. We can't be tired of this. All right. Because this is about trying to, this is the Sankofa principle. This is return and fetching what we need in this moment so that we can move forward. I'm not interested in regurgitating this. They talk about the critical race theory, blah, 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 you know, and you're just trying to keep the white people feeling bad and feeling guilty and putting us down and calling us the oppressor. Oh man, I don't even care about you like that, like that. That's not that, I'd get nothing out of that.
Yeah.
Okay. But the truth is the truth, and the truth shall make you free. So that's all we're doing. But, and we're not going to keep up with these lies. Like the when you had the liar in chief in office. No, we're not going back to that. We're not taking that. So, but if you don't want, but nobody's out here, it's not about putting anybody down. Look at the halftime for the Super Bowl, okay?
This past year?
Yeah. Now, if I was advising Jay-Z, or the NFL would have come to me for pay.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't be exhausted. Pay me what you pay. What, you know, give me some of that Jay-Z money.
Give you energy.
Give me that Jay-Z money. Here's what I'd have done. Leave Eminem alone. Why don't you bring Aquafina into the space? Why don't you bring some Cuban rappers who've been rapping about anti-Black racism in Cuba into the space? Why don't you bring some others in Senegal and Ghana? They know them. They're world class. They know all these people. Then you show the power from an LA out of this hip hop culture, of this rap music, whatever, R&B. You show the power of the culture as it moves out. But instead, you go to the little, you do your little tie thing, and you bring your white boy, and you know, he takes a knee, and that's all lovely and good, and I guess teaches the white people, but I'm beyond trying to teach the white people.
Yeah.
Saying Super Bowl touches the world. So let's show the world in this culture. Let's show the Asians that are moving in this cult, hip-hop culture. Let's show the Cubans and the Colombians, the Senegalese, the Ghanaians, the South Africans that are moving in this culture. India, I can take you to the Dalits in India and hip you on to Dalits that are using the culture to advance freedom, justice, equality, repair. So that's what you could do, Jay-Z, if you really want to blow up the spot.
Yeah.
From LA out to the world. So I'll take your call anytime, Jay-Z, and just come with the check. Get ready with the check, and I'll help you out.
In an interview that you did with Mass Live this past June, you were interviewed about your role in making Juneteenth a state holiday. You were quoted saying, "I'm a Southerner, a global South person." Can you elaborate on that?
I'll start,
yeah,
but again, this is something that we've done together. First off, I'm from Galveston. I'm from Galveston, Texas. It is the place in which General Granger and Black Union soldiers.
That's where they found.
That's where they went to read the proclamation, right?
Ending slavery.
So, you know, it's a touchstone for me. It has so much historical significance. We grew up as Texans celebrating Juneteenth. Like that was, yeah, you celebrate the 4th of July, but you also celebrate Juneteenth. And Juneteenth was more of a kind of intimate community celebrated holiday, some of the same, you know, barbecue and you had music, bands, and, you know, it was a festival. But you understood the histories, the significance of the history. So as Texans, we take a lot of pride in, you know, celebrating Juneteenth. There are no other holidays until recently that celebrated the ending of slavery, marked it and celebrated. Some, you know, there were, you know, some folks would celebrate, you know, midnight New Year's, you know, within the Black community. But Texas, we took it worldwide. We have friends that mark and celebrate Juneteenth in Japan. We have friends in Colorado. It's you know, it's national now, and particularly after, you know, this past year with Biden, it is official, right? But there was a lot of work in making that happen. And one of the things we did locally, we've been here around 14, 15 years now, as Texans that celebrated Juneteenth and understanding the historical significance, we joined with other community members, particularly the Cage family, who are our friends in all things good. And we started celebrating Juneteenth here in the community of Amherst. And so we created like community events to celebrate Juneteenth. And we've been doing that on a small scale. Last year was the first time in which the town fully joined with us to also mark the holiday in Juneteenth. And that combined with a lot of other people in the community, is just then so happened that it becomes the state and then the national holiday all at the same time. But this gentleman, really pushed that forward on the state level, kind of challenging our state reps to recognize Juneteenth as an official holiday. So I'm sure you want to
talk about that. About the Black South. And grab that globe right behind you. Grab that globe. Now, and show it to the camera so they see they see what you got. Take the little, take the cards out. Now, you see, the most of the planet Earth, all the technology, all the resources, it's all in the upper. Flip the globe over. Just turn it upside down. You see, in the actual universe, there's no, you know, north and south is about perspective. Yeah. Spin it around so they can see. Now you see, so we are trying to put the emphasis, because our roots go in the south, our ancestral roots, everything. Let's get the north-south divide closed, the wealth gap between the north and south. So yeah, we identify in the global south because that's where we come from, that's where our roots are from, and that's where the greatest needs. The climate crisis, it is hurting most in the areas of the global south, in the coastal areas all over the planet, but especially the rising sea levels is threatening the Caribbean, it's threatening Asia, the South America, all of it. So yeah, it's a point of identification for us as Southerners, not just Southerners of the U.S., but Southerners of the whole global South. Right.
But you want to talk about Juneteenth and how that connects us?
You said it. I already said it. We still struggle with freedom. You know, I tell people, I will say this, people ought to go read Biden's statement. I don't know who wrote it for him. But that proclamation is really well done, and it really embraces the truth. He learned from us on it that, you know, the thing with Juneteenth, it is about Black joy. It is about taking a moment, stopping the work, and just rebuilding, reconnecting, community, love, Black joy, all of that. But then with a sense of remembrance that the struggle continues. If you read Biden's statement, that double edge is in there, and that is what is the at essence with Juneteenth. We mark the end of slavery, and with we mark it with joy, with families coming together, with barbecue, red soda pop, all of that, and that's good and joyful for us. And the music, the blues, whatever we're doing, the jazz. But then we also, it is a solemn for us, because it also is about reflecting on the pains, on the hurts, on the harms that are still with us, that we have so much yet to do.
Are there any, you know, when you try to, a lot of your subject matter, just as an activist, what you're fighting towards may not be so palatable for your students. How do you make this palatable? You know, are there any anecdotes from your life and your activism work that you use to make what you're teaching palatable?
I like the
that makes it not exhausting.
I like the word they're palatable because it drives us to the palate, to the tongue. It drives us to our taste. It drives us to food. It drives us to what nourishes us. How do we take the medicine, take the food down in a way that, like you say, isn't exhausting or pain or too painful, but rather or only exhausting and only painful. And that's very important. And so, yeah, there are a lot of techniques we try to take to the classroom. We try to take outside in terms of doing this. And I would just say two quick things. And one is irony. And to how do we learn from irony? How do we learn from the ironic situations? And I'll tell you, the great teacher for me on that is a comedian, philosopher, deep person known as Richard Pryor. Mm. When Richard had burned himself up and everything, and we thought he was dead because, you know, it was like a watch. He's in the hospital. It was all touch and go. Nobody knew.
No internet
either. Yeah, and it wasn't like that. So we didn't know. I was literally crying, man, because that man had begun, had touched me and had awakened in me so much just there in the 70s, his bicentennial N-word, which he didn't use the N-word then. But that album alone, his television show that was in prime time until they killed it. And and even with when the hammer came down to cancel the show, you know, he did a little skit in one of the last episodes where he came out looking totally nude with no genitalia. That in his way, okay, he had been castrated and therefore was leaving the show now. But the show had to end. So he just was such a powerful person at grasping the irony of our situation and making it, to use your word, palatable. Palatable in the sense that you're ready to receive it. You can swallow it. You can get it down. As hard as it is, as painful as it is, you can take it in and be nourished by it. Okay? Be transformed by it. And that was a gift that brother had. And I try to learn from him, and I try to find ways to take the ironies of the situations that I'm trying to teach, the situations we're trying to address, and find ways to make it, as you say, palatable. Maybe it involves humor, different strategies where, hey, this is so ridiculous in its craziness. Let's find a way to laugh about it. Okay. That doesn't take the sting off entirely. That doesn't take away the truth of it, but it makes it palatable, okay? That we can draw it in. We can fetch it and take it in and be transformed by it. So irony is one technique to and way of approaching that, and humor with that irony. And I'll leave it there. I don't want to.
Well, you know what's something that I try to instill in whatever I'm teaching, because I teach film, I teach literature, social justice courses. I approach it, though, from a lens as a Black feminist. And one of the things I was teaching recently was about Phyllis Wheatley. And so, as we know, Phyllis Wheatley's writing in the 1700s at the time when she's first writing. She's still enslaved. And she has to prove that she's the actual author of her text, of her poetry. And what struck me in reading a printer's note that she sends to the printer for one of her poems that's going to be published, and she puts in that printer's note at the very end, She says, yes, this is authored by someone who is owned, you know, enslaved. And I am serving my masters, because she overhears this poem that she's talking about. She overhears the experience of, these two men at the dinner table while she's serving the masters. And so she puts that at the very end of her printer's note, while I am serving dinner, kind of like throwing, you know, signifying, throw what the young people, you know, she's throwing shade. Like, I'm doing all of this. Black genius me.
Yeah.
I'm doing all of this while I am serving here. I am enslaved. And so when I talk about the accomplishments, whether it's through literature or film, we have to understand this is Black genius that we are witnessing historically through art, you know, through some, you know, if we're talking about a historical figure, you know, I'm teaching the Black press, the folks that built the Black press, you know, this is Black genius with all sorts of odds, no resources, no models, no mentors. They had to literally make the map.
Yeah.
You know, and project themselves as a person because they weren't believed to be people. You know, they didn't were believed to have a soul. Mm-hmm. And project themselves free.
Yeah.
Whether they were in shackles or not. And so we have to understand when we're teaching, you know, about these folks, either historically or within the present, and bringing attention to and drawing attention to mainly white students we teach, it is to have them recognize.
Game, recognize, game.
That's it. That these folks are yeah. very, you know, in the midst of dire circumstances sometimes, even now, that they are conscious of just their mastery, that they are, you know, that what they bring to art, what they bring to, you know, oratory, you know, look at Frederick Douglass. These folks are conscious of the irony. They're conscious of the situation they're in, but they're also conscious of when they express themselves, it is genius. And it is the white people who are failing to see, failing to recognize, yeah. right? Those gifts, that genius.
Some of them.
But writing themselves into history,
yeah.
you know, very conscious of it.
Yeah.
You know, Douglass being one, Phyllis Wheatley being another. Although she, by the time she dies, you know, she's impoverished. She's impoverished. Black genius in action.
Just speaking back to media, you're talking about Black media. Do you ever feel like you're competing against the mainstream news? Because you work in Amherst Media. You work for Amherst Media.
I'm a board member.
You're a board member.
And a member. I'm a producer.
Yeah, of Amherst Media. And it can sometimes be a thankless job working for local news or working for local publications.
So we are competing.
Yeah.
We are competing. There's a lot of noise out there, so to speak. But, you know, a lesson that I get from the Black geniuses of the press, the Black press in particular, they weren't doing it for money.
Yeah.
You know, because they understood that, yeah, it'd be great if we could make a dollar, but we're really trying to just keep this enterprise afloat because we need a place where Black voices have an opportunity to express themselves. We need a place where we can create community, right? Through the Black press, through media, we create community, right? Someone's going to listen to this like, oh, I'm not alone and thinking a certain way. It's in a community of ideas. We are competing. Now, unfortunately, and I say it's unfortunate because the model that we have here in the U.S. is a commercial model, which means that it's about the capital. It's about the money. It shouldn't be, though. And not all over the world, in every country, is it based on profit? So this is the model we have in the U.S. So we're competing. We have to cut through a lot of noise, that is based on the money. Now, with that said, young people, so proud of them. They're doing it, anyway. Just like going back to the 1700s, the 1800s, when we did it, understanding that if we could stay afloat, then that's going to be okay. We probably won't make a profit. Sometimes we do. Yeah. Unique situation is sometimes we do, which is great. But that doesn't mean you are spreading a message even that is healthy and good for the community. I mean, we can go back to, BET wasn't all bad.
Yeah.
And it was Black owned at one time. It's no longer Black owned. But BET, the good parts of it is that it had its own news show at one time. That's gone, right? So, these are things that we need to keep in mind. We are competing. Do it. If you think it's important, do it anyway. Your message, your voice is important. And local media, which Amherst Media is an example of local access media, community media is even more important right now because it's all owned by conglomerates and corporations. Yeah. And so you have about three or four large media companies that own, not only newspapers, radio, television, et cetera. Exactly. They're everywhere. So local access, local media is much more critical, much more important right now because, the reality is that if something happens, let's say a car accident or a fire within your local town, that story is not going to make the broadcast, network television news show by 6 o'clock. That's not going to happen. Your local newspaper, if they're still around, it will make that. So it's unfortunate. That's where we are. So folks should begin investing just for their own, livelihood in terms of local, small towns. We need to start carrying our own news, whether it's through a podcast, whether it's a local newspaper, an online newspaper. We have two that started up in the last couple of years here in Amherst. We have two local online type of news outlets, all through volunteers. I think that's great. And they carry varying views. So we need that, and people of color need to do more of it. It's really critical, important. We have to have a difference of a views in the public.
How hard is it for what you do to be taken seriously is Amherst Media independently owned?
So Amherst Media, it comes out a 1970s law with the FCC where your cable company pays a percentage because of subscription. So whatever we pay as a subscriber to get our cable, in this case, it's Comcast. It could have been Charter, in Springfield or whatever. And your town negotiates with the cable company to get a percentage of those subscriber fees. And you can get in between 3% and 5%, depending on how you negotiate that with your town. I was part of that negotiation process. We ended up getting 5%, which is the highest amount you could get for subscription fees. What that enables us to do is that we have three channels. One is a public one where, let's say you have your own show, you can show that on there. The other one's education. So the school district has a show and then you have a government show. So all the government shows having to do with town council. All right. What that does is provide another voice that's competing, right? Competing with major television stations like a NBC, CBS. So the hyper-local becomes so important. That's how it's paid for, your subscriber fees to cable. as people begin to cut the cord, the laws are changing, those subscription fees are lessening, not just in Amherst, but across the nation. Yeah. And so, again, it's vitally important that people value hyper-local, local news, local stations, and you can pay a membership fee. You can make a donation to make sure it survives, because we don't know what's around the corner in terms of not only news, but media. So that's how it's paid for.
Okay.
Donations and subscription fees by folks paying for cable.
Do you ever feel like there's pressure to make more sensationalized headlines or stories, be a part of more sensational news cycle to get more, you know, to get that clickbait, a term often used when talking about, you know, just getting engagement with your content?
I leave that to social media folks.
Yeah.
I mean, we do put part of, you know, we utilize social media to get attention for our shows. So we have a show that we do called Difficult Dialogues. And I think it's sensational enough locally, because when you talk about reparations locally, people want to hear about that. Yeah. People want to know more about it. We also interview folks not only who are locally based, we interview folks who are nationally or internationally known. So for folks who watch or listen to us, you know, it's enough. Again, we're not doing it for profit, because we don't make any money off of this. This is a not-for-profit enterprise. It's important as a vehicle to educate others. And so I don't think that's my motivation, although, you know, people may tune into you because it seems much more, you know, some of the folks you interview, he interviews some really interesting people. But it's not about profit. It's about educating others. So we don't feel that same pressure, I think. If we were in a network, you know, in CBS, NBC, you know, one of those major type of, you know, corporations, that type of thing, I'm sure we'd feel that pressure, but we don't. We don't have to feel that pressure. So,
I mean, we do it together. We interviewed a pastor in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who was the pastor of the church that was at ground zero of the destruction of Black Wall Street.
Wow.
The destruction of the Greenwood community, historic African-American community of Tulsa 100 years ago in 1921. So we did an episode in 2021 to capture and to educate about what was going on there. And it's a difficult dialogue in the sense that, you know, it brings into relief the struggles we're doing here in Amherst to try to recognize the harm and to recognize the difficulties in terms of anti-Black racism has posed here in Amherst. But we looked at it in Tulsa as a juxtaposition. And so we both were part of that interview with Reverend Robert Turner, who was at the historic Vernon AME Church. We have an AME church here that we're fighting to keep from burning down and to restore it to its greatness in terms of Goodwin Memorial. So, you know, there are connections to the local in that dialogue that we organized, even though we were talking to a national figure, someone who was at that time all the way in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So we do shows like that.
Yeah. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I just, you know, the thing is that that's a story that people wouldn't have known about.
Yeah.
You know, had we not done that show, they wouldn't have known about, you know, Reverend Robert, who we knew from University of Alabama. They wouldn't have known possibly, I mean, maybe a few, about that history within Tulsa, you know, that still hasn't been fully recognized. There's a couple of documentaries that came out recently, but, you know, that is an underrepresented history when it comes to Black folk and the harms mm-hmm. that occurred. So, you know, bringing those things to light, are really important. That's what we do.
Connections to the local. Our senator, Elizabeth Warren, is from Oklahoma. She was the senator that put the legislation forward in the U.S. Senate to acknowledge the centennial of the race massacre in Tulsa. All right, and people say, well, why is a Massachusetts senator doing that? Well, because all the senators from Oklahoma are the anti-critical race theory senators. And they weren't putting anything forward. So she didn't do it to shame them. She did it because that's her home state. She knew she had learned the history, had come to learn the history, and she felt it would have been a tragedy to not have the Senate, which speaks on historic things all the time, you know, and passes resolutions out of the Senate. So she put the legislation forward. So we wanted to have to amplify that legislation coming from our own senator here in Massachusetts to understand the connection points that it matters, that it really matters. And so we were able to do that with Reverend Robert Turner and to expose kind of what all was going on there. We enjoyed that show. In fact, the show got mentioned in NAMIC, got an award with the, tell them what NAMIC is again.
Yes, and I'm going to mess it National up, but Alliance the National Alliance of Minority Communicators and are in communication. And there's a local chapter or a regional chapter, the Northeastern NAMIC. And I'm on the board. We're very active, and it's for media professionals of color.
But they honored us with an award for that show. I mean, for Difficult Dialogue. So, you know, we appreciated that recognition for it, and that people didn't, you know, could see that this is how, this is the power of this kind of hyper-local journalism, this kind of local access. It's not just, hyper-local doesn't mean it's just on the local. Mm-hmm. It just means it's from the local, and it's always trying to draw these connections that matter to the local.
Yeah, I was once told that most big national and international news stories start off as local news stories. So that makes sense. Actually, it was a question that I had, and you kind of just answered that.
Absolutely. Already. Another example of that is, you know, the whole water crisis, right? That happened.
In Flint.
Yeah. That was a local news story. It didn't start off as a national or state news. Local newspaper, local reporters trying to look into this. So it grows from that into a national news story. But it took a while. And it started off as a local news.
Yeah.
So that's a perfect example of how that happens, you know, and why we need hyper-local news.
Do you ever feel like it almost becomes a game of telephone, because it'll start off locally, but of course, you know, the narrative will change over time, the more platforms that it reaches, and, you know, then it can get sensationalized, you know, exaggerated as time progresses.
Well, you know, history's a game of telephone.
Yeah,
right. True. So, you know, those stories start off one way, and then by the time, you know, 20, 40, 50, 100 years later, it's something else. So I think what's important within that lesson is that we need to control our narratives. So, you know, Black folk, people of color, if it's an important part of your community's history, you need to tell it and retell it.
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of the old thing of oral histories. Make sure grandma tells that story about, you know, your origin story of how y'all go from Mississippi to Chicago or from Jamaica to New York.
Yeah.
You know, tell that story over and over again and control that narrative. You know, and sometimes in the telling, yes, things get exaggerated, things get changed, but own it and try to take the good with the bad. The story of Flint is a great example of folks within that community being, you know, kind of bought off in a sense and not caring enough about the community of color, you know, and what they're drinking. Story of Black Lives Matter on a hyper-local, you know, way. So we need to do the telling and retell and control those narratives, both historically and within, you know, within the now.
And that goes back to you saying that more Black people need to be involved in the media, local media.
We have to be content producers. And what's the blessing of now and the technologies that are available, we can do that in so many ways. You know, you can do that through audio and a podcast. You could do that through, you know, a 4K camera or a 10K camera and take your camera out. Just taking photos, you know, and it's something that I teach media literacy. It's not, you know, teaching media literacy from a theoretical point of view and talking about why young people should be critical consumers of the media. That's one thing. Young people need to be makers of their own stories, right? They need to be content producers, whether it's through a graphic novel, using their phones. I don't care. Become content producers and tell more than just what you, you know, ate at that restaurant or, you know, who's dating who. Mm-hmm. Tell the stories that matter and that impact your community.
Don't be afraid.
Yeah.
Some of us are brave.
You about to continue to rhyme? You guys grew up in Texas. I'm kind of bouncing around, but you know, it's all pertinent. You guys grew up in Texas, which is historically a conservative state. Then you moved to Oklahoma, also conservative.
Alabama, then Oklahoma.
Oh, then Alabama, then Oklahoma. Also conservative. After moving here in Massachusetts, which I guess isn't conservative. Depending on who you're asking, what are the differences and similarities of the Southwest and the South and the Northeast?
Oh, differences in the food. There's differences in customer service. differences in how you know people relate in some ways. There's sometimes not a whole lot of difference in the police. Some things stay the same, but you know, it's a human. We all having a human experience, and despite you know, in spite of the regional differences or moving through regional differences, I think that people are looking for change. Some folks are looking for change or ready for change. I think those. You know, devastating 8 plus 9 minutes of George Floyd, you know, dying on a, you know, somebody's cell phone, you know, who was brave enough to just hold it right there and say, yo, man, you know, you're killing that man, to witness and to be able to have that digital witness go out to the world for all of us to see. You know, this transition, that's in what, freaking Minnesota?
Yeah.
What is that? You know, that's not Alabama.
Yeah.
That's not Texas. That's not, you know, so
far from them.
Yeah. So what's going on here? America? Is this America? Is Fannie Lou Hamer in tone? Is this America? So, yeah, the regional thing is, I think, in some ways, just kind of all exploded.
Yeah.
It's gone. It's exploded. This is America.
Yeah. We're talking. Regardless.
As Childish Gambino, you know, pointed out, this is America. So what are we going to do now? let's get off the you know, bashing the Alabama, you know, inbreeding and bashing. I was thinking of South Park, you know, where that's, you know, I always like to go down South Park, the inbred Alabamians and the Texans and all that. No. This is America. So what do we do now? Okay. Dick Cheney blowing off people's face. That's up north. You know, the white supremacists in Oregon and out there on the far northwest want to break off an Aryan nation. You know, this is America. And right here where we are in Massachusetts, in New England, this is America. So, you know, let's widen the lens, and turn the lens on all of this country, and then take a deep look at what do we really want to do here? What do we really want to be here? And are we ever going to take the high-minded words of the Declaration of Independence, of the Constitution, of whatever else, and really translate it to real life, everybody?
Yeah.
Or not?
Do you feel like your experiences teaching all over America has shaped any part of you?
Oh, yeah. Shaped and continues to. Yeah. I was just... a little while ago, distinguished visiting professor at the University of Iowa. My first time to go to that state. And, you know, it's, you know, I have been blessed to move around, you know, through many, many, many parts of this country. And it shapes me to do that, because I am able to see and to realize. I was just on virtually in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, not far from the place in Wisconsin where the boy was acquitted.
Kenosha.
Yes, coming out there shooting up, you know, shooting people, white people, you know, white on white violence. It continues to shape me and worry me, because, you know, it's not about hating America or loving America. It's about whether we want to see this experiment in the human experience elevate and sustain and move forward into this millennium, or whether we are really ready to just punch out and go into extinction as a species, between climate change, between all this crazy violence, and everything. Do we just want to extinguish ourselves, or do we want to live and live life abundantly? So yeah, the moving around, the travel, this is my birth month. So I have that Aquarian energy. I have that ass.
I'm an Aquarius as well.
See? Mm-hmm. So yes, it does. It works for me.
You know, one of the things when you talk about teaching all over is, you know, my teaching technique, particularly when I'm teaching something that isn't specifically labeled as, you know, African American studies or women's studies, and I've taught in both areas, but let's say film history. And so when you think of film history and you think of the film canon, you know, young people come to the class expecting that we're going to talk about Coppola, Spielberg, you know, these white guys who are talented in their own right. But as far as my teaching technique as a Black feminist, I try to purposely decenter the white boys. And again, it's not hate against them. It's not recognizing what they bring to film history, but I'm an educator. And so if we're going to teach film history, then let's teach and show the women of color, for instance, who were part of early film history and the silent era. Because in a way, to borrow the very Western you know, metaphor, it was the Wild Wild West, where folks with a camera would pick it up, you know, and make a movie.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, Black folk, that was Native Americans, that was Latin Americans, that was, you know, African Americans. And you had these independent filmmakers that have gone, you know, unrecognized. Michaud now is getting his due.
Yeah.
So, you know, I decenter this whole canon of white male filmmakers. And what that does to some students, not all students, some students don't bat an eye.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, this is new. This is what she's teaching. Didn't know this. However, some students say, well, this is not what I signed up for.
But that's in the this class is, that was labeled
yes.
feminist. That was labeled women.
Well, but then also film history. I get some of those same things, those same reactions. Yeah. Because they're not used to seeing America as people of color,
yeah.
as, yeah, yeah. You know, women, as LGBTQ, you know, they're not used to seeing this huge palette within the classroom. Hmm. And if we really want to teach to be socially just and inclusive, folks, you know, our faculty, we need to decolonize our minds and our curriculum and stop placing white men at the center of whatever you're teaching.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's math, oh my gosh, let's look to
Newton.
That's it. Yes. Let's, you know, let's look to South America and the Mayans and the Aztecs. Let's look to, you know, Egypt. Because those are demonstrations of genius and mathematics,
yeah.
you know, and astronomy. You know, let's look to the Quran. Within the Quran, in there Egypt. Is writings of, you know, astronomy and philosophy and science. But again, if you don't decenter your curriculum from you know, this white male canon, we're not going to really learn from one another. And so I think, you know, when you talk about teaching all over, that is how it has influenced me. I need to decolonize my curriculum.
Yeah.
And that is what I try to do.
Well, you know, you did all of that. You know, you're trying to do all of that, decolonize your curriculum. Do you ever think about, you know, maybe if you taught it in HBCU, you know, maybe you wouldn't have to decolonize your curriculum. You know, there'd be no decolonization at all. It would be easy for you to just incorporate black film, black filmmakers, or filmmakers of color in your curriculum. So, you know, why teach this in a PWI, predominantly white university, and not an HBCU?
So that takes up two things for me. And you know, I have to just offer a little pushback
yeah.
on what is available in HBCUs.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you find the most entrenched and conservative folks within HBCUs. Mm. Gotcha, man. So
respectability politics. Well,
truth. Yeah, and so, you know, when my first exposure to an HBCU was in celebration, I think it was in celebration of Malcolm X's birthday.
Yeah.
And so me and some white allies and some other people of color are at the HBCU that was near my predominantly white university I was attending, and we had joined with some students from the HBCU to celebrate Malcolm X's birthday. We were kicked off of the campus as troublemakers. So, you know, just for celebrating Malcolm X's birthday. And of course, this was over 20 years ago, but that was my first introduction. Now, more than that, you're right. Okay, I'm dating myself. But, you know, I think of places like Howard University. Howard University's film and communication program is stellar. I would say any young person, white, black, Latino, you want to study art and film, definitely. That is a a choice you should make, you know, possibly going to Howard University. It just depends. What I'm saying is that there's an assumption that you will find a more liberal, inclusive, and diverse curriculum.
Yeah.
At an HBCU. That is not always the case. So just yeah. like you would scout out if you're interested in attending or teaching
yeah.
at a particular university, you need to figure out who is there, what is their kind of philosophy, and what's their history in teaching these subject areas that are still considered, unfortunately, non-traditional. An African-American studies history course should never be non-traditional. That should be part of the history.
Especially when we're 13% of the population.
Absolutely. Yeah. Women in film and African cinema, that should never just be, you know, in any film program.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's an elective. No, that should be part of learning about not only the history of film, but about some really talented cinematographers, such as, you know, a filmmaker such as Haile Gerima, yeah. you know, of Sankofa, who, you know, is teaching at Howard. So, again, do your research. Not every, you know, the saying is not every brother is a brother, meaning not every, you know, Black person or Black institution has the same type of ideology. Right. That is about diversity. That is about embracing, you know, difference. Yeah, so I just want to make that clear.
Because I've taught at an HBCU. In fact, my teaching career began at Prairie View. Full-time teaching began at Prairie View A&M in Prairie View, Texas. Now, there are ebbs and flows. And I studied the history of higher ed. So it ebbs and flows. At Prairie View, there were two geniuses. We talked about Black genius in Jewel Prestige, first African-American woman to earn a PhD in political science from Iowa at the University of Iowa. Jewel Prestige was my dean and the head of the Division of Political Science and Geography, where history was in that division, was Mac Jones, Mac Henry Jones. So they called me and said, look, we got a full-time position for a year in the honors. You'll be in the honors college with Dr. Prestige. You'll also teach. It's a 4-4 load, 4-4 plus extra work. And some of it will be in the regular non-honors history courses, but some will be honors that you're teaching. 4 classes each semester. Do you want the job? Well, we were having a baby. I wanted to have a little more income and yeah. benefits and everything than a TA ship, a teaching assistantship. So I went to work to Prairie View. And years later now, the current president, so that's back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Now the current president, Ruth Simmons, former president of Smith College down the road, former president of Brown University, and many other accomplishments, native Texan. She's back home in Texas. They call her out of retirement to come and head up Prairie View. And she gets there and she scans, why is there no African-American studies, no Africana studies here?
Mm.
And it's a Black institution.
The irony.
So she said she got a Mellon grant over $1 million to try to work on developing Africana studies in department at Prairie View. Okay. Why, though, it becomes the question. So in the 90s, when we were there, we took up the question. I took it up with Jewel Prestige, with Mac Jones, with Imari Obadeli, who was a professor there. And we said, why? We've got scattered courses. We got a couple of things, Black literature over here in English. We got a couple of things over here in history. We got a couple of things in some other fields, the music, the arts. Why can't we pull it together into at least a minor program? If not growing it to a major? Well, the person that was over the university at this time, this general, he was a general from the U.S. Army, General Julius Becton. Decent guy, but, you know, red, white, and blue, Colin Powell type, all that kind of thing. His thing was that, you know, we're already bringing the Black students here. It's an affirming, it's a positive, it's a pro-Black environment, it's a Black majority environment. It's already affirming. The thing now isn't to give them more Black. That's blackety black, black, black. That's OTEP. They don't need that. We got, now that we got them here comfortable, safe in this Black affirming space, let's load them up with the Western white stuff that they'll need to move in the world. We don't want your Black studies. We need the whiteness. We need to prepare them for the white world. Mm. So that was the ideological, if you wish to say, but that was the pushback to us saying, let's create a Black studies minor. We don't need that because it's already, we're Black enough already.
Right. Yeah.
But that's not intellectual, because you don't learn Black history, you don't learn Black literature, you don't learn Black music, Black contributions to the arts, Black, you don't learn that just by osmosis, just because you may grow up in a Black household.
Yeah.
Or you're now at a Black college surrounded 90%, whatever, Black students, still doesn't mean you know your culture in its full and can study your culture. So now they're getting on it. It's 2022. They're starting to get on the construction of Black studies at Prairie View. And what Dr. Simmons found is it's characteristic of most of the HBCUs that Africana studies is underdeveloped or not, doesn't exist at all. So it's a project. It's National Council for Black Studies. You know, I'm here to say it is a growing project. Yeah. Howard is very strong. With Greg Himathi Carr and others, you know, there's certain campuses where HBCUs where, Black FAMU down in Florida, Florida A&M University, there have been some that have been very strong and have grown, but overall, it's very anemic, and it has a lot to do with that idea that, oh, it's already a Black, we're a Black space, we're a Black majority, safe space. It's now to give them the tools they need to move in the white-dominated world. Unfortunately, that's the kind of analysis or what we encountered as we've tried to push in years past. But I'm happy to say that since and result of the racial reckoning and Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, there is a process of change that we're there's a flow now toward greater work at the HBCUs in this area,
which is it's so ironic because. So many corporations after the murder of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd in their commercials, you know, every sports league is going hard with Black History Month decals on the court and in the football field. Like you go on Target, they go super hard with Black History, anything, the cards.
You and JCPenney and got Juneteenth napkins. Right. All kind of Juneteenth gear they had before Juneteenth was the national holiday. Yeah, it's going hard.
So, you know, and these are white companies.
Virtue signaling.
So the fact that HBCUs that were created for the children of slaves to get an education are, you know, they're overcompensating. It's it's not something you would expect, but it goes back to the unlearning, you know, them unlearning the white supremacy, because that whole conformity.
Unlearning being slaves.
Yeah. Right.
Nobody was a slave.
Yeah.
As an identity. Mm-hmm. People were of African heritage.
Yeah.
That's what you were. You were an African. Mm-hmm. You weren't a slave. You were an enslaved African. But that doesn't define your identity. Your identity was you were from somewhere in Africa. Okay? But the oppressor says, the enslaver says, now you are a slave. You erase all of those prior identities and you are a slave.
Yeah.
And then after emancipation, after Juneteenth, then they said for a minute at least, you're American now. So you go from slave to American, and where's African in the space? Where's your Africanity in the space? And so we had to go through the 60s and say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud. We went skin deep with the analysis. In the 80s, we pushed the analysis further and said, no, we got to bring geography into it. But where we are now in 2022, it's beyond the skin. It's beyond the color. It's beyond the geography. It's now we're talking about us being, whether or not, what is it to be human?
Yeah.
And to push what it is to be human. And if human as a category cannot incorporate people who look like us, then what are we doing on this planet?
Yeah.
It's like Derek Bell. Maybe it's time for us to go on and get on the mothership and get up out of here. If you ever read that story of Derek Bell on when the mothership comes and they tell the white people that or the non-blacks, give us all your blacks. We're going to take them up on this ship and we're going to cure cancer for you. We're going to give you a technology to have an inexhaustible, renewable source of energy. No more climate change problems. We're going to take care of basically all your major problems on the planet in exchange. No questions asked. Give us all your black people. And the story goes from there. No spoiler alert. I'll say go read Derek Bell on that particular story.
I think this is a good place to, you know, wind down. Why do you feel like our history needs to be archived?
So we can be wise, Akil.
Yeah.
Isn't that what Akil means?
Yeah, it does. Intelligent one, yep.
The only way to be intelligent is you preserve the artifacts that can tell you how you've walked on, how humans have walked on this planet before. If you don't preserve something that lets you know how you've walked on this planet, how you've lived in this space, then you know, it's like amnesia. You wake up, you don't know what's what. So yes, we must build the archive, and that archive must include us, our archives in it.
Yeah.
It's Sankofa. It's Sankofa, you know, within the image of the bird with the, you know, the neck turned towards the past and the seed in their mouth. It is the seed. That history is the seed that carries us to the future, because you have to plant that seed in order to grow. And, you know, within their black genius of creating that image and the aphorism that he said earlier, you know, that Akan aphorism of it's not taboo, right? We need to decolonize our minds, as you know, as we say, in order to take that seed and remember the past, but go and build the future.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to wrap up. So last question, what do words matter to you, both you guys?
The two poets that first taught me the power of words, one was Langston Hughes, and that's real young. And then as I went to college, learned about Sonia Sanchez. And so those two really teach and continue to teach me the power of words. And with Sonia, the word can become, you can go way beyond what you think you know. It's the power of sound. So words, sound, power is what's linked as like a trinity. Word, sound, power. The power of the word, nomo. No more. I'll leave it at that.
In the beginning, it was the word. We speak ourselves into existence. And the way I honor my ancestors is celebrating their words. Because in a time in which they were said to not be human.
Yeah.
Said to not have a soul, to lack intelligence. That black lives did not matter, in other words. We must understand that we speak ourselves into existence. We continue that legacy. And we must celebrate and preserve that and understand the value and its importance.
Kuji Chagaliya. Name ourselves, self-determination.
So that's a great way to wrap that up. Thank you, Dr. Demetria Shabazz, and thank you, Dr. Emil Carr Shabazz, for everything that you do and everything you will continue to do. And Dr. Demetria Shabazz, for everything you've done for me as a student and for being a part of Words Matter. And thank you, everybody. Please, it's my first time saying this. I always forget to say it. Rate, comment, and subscribe. And if you guys have anything that you need to plug, you can do that.
You got it, bro. Thank you, Akil. We plug okay. you.
That's it.
Words matter.
Listen to Akil. Words matter.
Words matter. All right. Thank you.
Ashe.
Thank you. Thank you.